had an opportunity to spend my time on projects. I had done my service. What you do career-wise.
Right. So you established this scholarship. That's wonderful.
Term.
Yeah. Well, so, the question that we left with, I think, was about what kinds of students were like in the 60s when there were the war was unpopular, 60s and early 70s when the war was unpopular. Were there protests? Were there, what was the general feeling on campus at that time?
It was reflected on the local campus, just as you have read about it on larger campuses. But the active portion of it was not at the highest level. You could get a touch of it by going to the student newspaper that period and seeing what they were excited about or what they were concerned about. I never expected to come down and see myself hanging from the flagpole. But that was the general tenor of students were expressing as contempt for authority and the decisions that the past generation had made. And that was their way of coming of age. And as you recognize similarities if you have had either the experience over that long period of time or have studied to know what student life was like, what they were concerned about and so on. But it was an interesting time in that you made accommodation for and sought out means of student expression that would not have occurred without that kind of foment. By reason of involving the students more in the facing the reality, they were able to partially close that gap between what they thought it was like and what the reality was. Mm-hmm. And as a result, continued the process of maturity. And as Neil would say 10 years later, you've learned an awful lot since I've been gone. You know?
All of a sudden you know more than you did when you when they were there.
Yeah. And so, and there's always that satisfaction that I have of receiving Christmas cards or whatever. Even I had some letters when the news was out that I had a heart attack. I had letters across the state of people that I had enjoyed as students and worked with, but didn't have an opportunity to follow up on it. And as many of them said, I know this is a late time for me to tell you what this has meant to me, what my experience at Eastern was, and what your influence on my life has been. Mm. Those things helped you get well. Because they were willing to sit down and write it out and sit away until you die and put it in a newspaper someplace. Mm-hmm. Gee, you'd be missed because you did this and this and this. Mm-hmm. So.
And then as you went into the 70s, did you see an additional change in the student behavior or attitude toward learning, or was it sign of the times?
Yes. Particularly particularly because they had less and less experience Well, how shall I phrase that? Many of them had come up during the post-war period and were upset by Vietnam, Korean conflict and so on, whole thing, but Vietnam particularly, because students found their expression so that they didn't wait until they were returning from Vietnam to say, let's get together with some veterans of Vietnam and we'll be against the war. knowing what they know about that. But they were willing to be more active because they knew they were captive of the system.
Mm-hmm.
And other thing is being equal. Ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
Ma'am.
Yeah. So what was the reaction to Vietnam on campus?
Well, you can't encapsulate it into a general milieu.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was highly individualized in the sense that those who were very much involved in living an examined life were taking great pains to try to find others of their persuasion and see if they couldn't do something about it. System being what it was, there wasn't a whole lot they could do about it.
Mm-hmm. Was there peace marches? Did they have sit-down strikes or anything that was happening in the larger university?
Not really. Not really. I don't recall a serious incident. Because you forget for a period and you mellow a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that we're on the verge of causing you to begin to have an ulcer or something. You found a way to meet that with the kind of calm that if you were able to project to them, enable them to try to find a different expression for their concern, because part of it was they were really not able to translate what was occurring into something that they could verbally cope with. Feelings of frustration with the system, what they viewed as a lack of recognition of the importance of what they were attempting to do in terms of getting started in the system.
Did you find that the students that were at Eastern in the 70s embodied the me generation that people talk about, that there was a selfishness or a lack of respect at all in students in the classes? Or?
Yes, but there was still a core faculty-student relationship that carried itself forward. In other words, students coming in that might have expected this kind of environment on the campus found that there were students who genuinely appreciated what faculty were doing. And, you know, they couldn't understand what's so great about this class or that class. So that there was never a period when the entire student body had an us versus them relationship there. We still had managed to retain personal one-on-one relationship that we had developed when the school was small. And we still found time to deal with those who were most lost. And we weren't always successful. Everybody hadn't botched up their life anyway. You know?
Uh-huh.
But you had an opportunity to try so that you would go the second mile with them. To my knowledge, we were beginning to get faculty members that wanted to adopt university faculty ways, but had not had experience on university campus. Mm-hmm. So that they were thinking about, we should be able to be in control and do this and this and this without knowing how the system had developed and why there were such arrangements as faculty status dealt to those on your campus. Part of that, I'm sure, might have been due to impacts of different administrations here. For example, Frank Bennett had been a school superintendent too long to become immediately an effective college administrator, because there was only one way to do it, and that's Frank's way. And so yours not the reason why, you're just we're told this is the way I'm going to organize it, play it. And he expected the college faculty to respond the way secondary and elementary teachers respond. However, he remained long enough to gradually learn how to share. And as he learned how to share, he was retained in the faculty.
So who are some of your favorite colleagues over the years at Eastern? Who's in your memory?
We had a different experience than most people. The original faculty was hired largely from secondary schools. And so you had the laboratory school faculty actually as the core group, and John Miller, director of education, set the general tone for what was going to occur. The rest of the program it had to grow from the point where it was a normal school to where departments had some responsibility to a broader range of students than just elementary teachers. And so the people who could make that transition stood out in my mind. There were only two of us retained out of the AFCTD faculty to be Pyongyang for the opening of civilian students again.
So the AFFTD stood for, what was it?
American Air Force College Training Detachment.
Okay.
Dr. Martha Addy and I were the only two students, or the only two faculty members, given post-war employment with the original faculty that was here.
So, Addy is A-D-D-Y. What was she like?
Well, she had just come off of a stint in the military, and she wanted to relate to students. So, she went to the board and she wrote all the four-letter words that she could think of and turned to the class and said, "I've had it all. I've been in the military. I know what's going on." She raised them. She had finished her graduate work and was pretty sure who she was and what she wanted to do. And as a result, introduced the kinds of things that became a hallmark of students going through, not least of which was the recognition of community service and the actual checkup on a individual basis, what your experience was, and, you know, whether you were singing in the Methodist choir or whether you were helping out in Greenwood Library or whatever. So, her main course was in Ed Psych, and she had a great deal of impression on the students who went through her classes. I recall speaking at her memorial service, telling some of the things that she was capable of. One was that she was a great believer in multiple choice and true false tests, and would give exams that were very exhausting. And she made sure that those exams covered all of the basic material that was, she thought, necessary to graduate and go out in the world. She made sure that some of the copies of her exams sneaked out into the dorms and so on, so that students read sweat blood over these things.
So she was real strict?
Yeah, made that. And as she told me, I want to see them actually transfer from just knowing about something to knowing something. So I would never change my examination questions, but I would just change the key from year to year. The answers were not the same. Which meant that if you had just memorized for the test, you'd bluffed it. And if you had actually studied from it and could read into it, you would see that there was a possibility for another answer that would be almost as important. So Martha Addy was a very solid influence on the core of students coming through at the point where, because she was with me during the expansion into secondary education.
So how long was she at Eastern?
Until she died. That must have been in the 60s.
So from the 40s, mid-40s to
the 60s? Yeah. Uh-huh. You should have interviewed me before I lost my memory.
Oh, you're amazing. I don't think you need to worry.
Well, I'm just thinking that I could go back to college catalogs and see who exactly went to different periods and met me when we had pinned Martha down as when her purity was.
Yeah.
Or to student newspapers or to the annuals. So, I think in 46, either 46 or 47, George Nightingale and I were given responsibility for back in sponsors for a hand for a yearbook.
Oh my.
So that didn't that particularly matter that you did not have journalistic background or artistic did you were somebody who made sure that the students got one put out.
Yeah. Now George Nightingale, the Nightingale Gallery is named after, right?
Oh, yeah. He was
what was he like?
He was, I would say, an artist's artist in the sense that not only did he teach the art classes, but like some of the rest of us, he attempted to teach a way of life about it. Mm-hmm. And as a result, really got through to students the art education experience that could be a part of elementary curriculum. So the same way that Ben Bishop did for music, so that you could teach, you could handle your own music and your own art. It was the kind of thing that George wanted to grow and expand the department and be able to get different experiences incorporated into it. I guess the same way that Al Kaiser and Dick Hyatt wanted to treat the speech and theater section. I remember Dick Hyatt as a student going through and then returning to the faculty. Some of my favorite people were people that I spent recreation time with. Al Kaiser, Joe Kaiser, Ralph Badgley. Even though I was younger in age, I represented post-war addition to the faculty because it was several years before we were able to start expanding and hiring people like Dr. Lozo and others to come on board. So the very natural social development was old faculty, new faculty, and the Eastlands. Dr. Addy. We were sort of in between. We were neither old faculty or new faculty. New faculty were those that came after we had enough students that we could actually add faculty like we did in 51, 52. And we moved into the secondary. That didn't lessen what students were getting from, say, Dr. Zabel. She was a towering giant.
Why was she that way?
Why
do people talk about her a lot?
She had the richness of experience to go with the interpretation of what others had written about it, so that she could open whole new avenues, new business to students. And transfer to them an excitement about the desire for learning. That aren't, you know, this is not something that everybody possesses, but it's neither is it something you necessarily can make sure is going to happen. The person sets out to become that kind of an individual may or may not arrive, but she had arrived and she had that background of knowing the field. In the same manner that Ralph Badgley not only knew the physics, but knew all of the mathematics that made it possible, and as a result had a much broader view of science, which is why our students were given preference in med school, dental school, well, if they're graduate from Eastern, we don't even have to look too much at their record because this is what Eastern students have done. They can, and it was in the way that they taught, Badgley and Zabel in particular, that enable students to grasp and to grow, even some of the few students that came back and were added to the faculty. I guess Gerald Young, Dick Hyatt, Jacob.
So Jerry Young graduated from Eastern?
Pardon?
Jerry Young graduated from Eastern,
yes.
As well? How did you know that?
Well, learn something new every day.
Yeah.
Stick around. See where the roots go.
There you go. I was wondering about the recreation that you and you said Badgley and some other. What kind of recreation did you do?
Our greatest opportunity to get out varied with the individual. For example, Al Kaiser was a confirmed duck hunter. I would no more crawl on my belly across the frozen ground in order to pop a duck coming out of the thing. But we totally enjoyed each other's company, and he taught me so much about fly fishing on the Lower River that, for years we would take his mobile trailer up and park it along the parking spot on the Lower River. For opening day of trout season, and we would have all the materials there to prepare breakfast, and our friends would come in between 8 o'clock in the morning and noon, and we'd prepare breakfast for them as they went on up for opening day. And finally at maybe 11 or 11:30 we'd get out of line and make a ceremonial cast in the river and pull it back in, because you don't fly fish on opening day for any success because the water is still rather roiling. But that meant that every fall we would take 4 to 5 days and backpack into the Lyle Lake Country. And we would hike in, carry our packs, go from lake to lake, fish, enjoy the total setting. This is before they allowed horses up there to grind the trails in the dust.
Yeah. So were there very many people doing that?
This is why you said you were going into the wilderness, and then for all practical purposes, it was. And you wanted to go in and you wanted to leave it just the way you found it. Mm-hmm. So you packed anything in when you packed it out.
So how heavy were your packs?
Oh, probably 4 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't pack heavy. We we knew that we could not live on fish, but we took things like dehydrated applesauce, other things that you can add water to and become really a part of the food. And,
when did you start going up into the Willamette? Roughly?
In the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Just as soon as we got gasoline, because to fish before then meant more than 5 miles away on the Grand Ronde River. Mm-hmm. We didn't have gasoline there, too. But as soon as gasoline became available, we began to explore Japan. We spent many times going into the Little Minam River, going up to the end of the trail, going in. At that time, the trail was 7 miles long. I mean, at the time, the trail that is 7 miles long now was about 3 miles. It's deep coming in and going out. The current trail is longer. But the Little Minam was a perfect stream for fly fishing.
What kind of fish did you catch?
Rainbow trout.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this was the reason for the existence of the stream. It had been logged in the 20s.
Copy of the article about you. That would be great. I'd love to have a copy of this.
That's the only copy that I know in existence.
Yeah. I wonder if they have a copy machine down in the office here that they could make me a copy.
Oh, yeah, they do.
Yeah, but I'll do this. If it's all right with you, before I leave, I'll make a copy of this.
They can't copy anything that large.
Oh, yeah, maybe they have a shrinker. Well, sometimes you can copy each piece and then paste it.
Well, yeah, you can do that because this would copy onto an 8 and a half. What you wake up wanting to do before the sun goes down that will give you an opportunity to help others. My gosh, that sounds...
That's a nice quote.
Wisdom of the ages.
And there you are. There's your answer. But that would be wonderful to accompany the taped interview, because what we're doing is the oral history, so we want people's voices. And but that would be wonderful to accompany the oral history.
I haven't read all of this since 89. I haven't read it in 89. I just took it and put it in the file.
Oh, wonderful.
Easily appreciate all the opportunities he's had during his 46 years in the Grand. He's found the area a great place to develop those relationships with his family and longtime friends. Whom he values above all else. Said he would desire young people to become involved in their community, but be very selective about how thin they spread themselves. You have to be willing to recognize that in whatever group you're involved, 15% of the people are going to do 85% of the work. You have to make time for those things that are important. Birthdays don't have much impact. What's important is...
Great.
Old philosopher.
Sounds wonderful. Well, I will see if they'll make me a copy before I leave and bring that back to you. Maybe my last question for you is advice. What advice would you give to especially teachers who are, you know, probably among the least well-paid?
I haven't really lived long enough to be able to give advice to If a person has found themselves through teaching, then theirs is a most rewarding experience compared to all other endeavors of mankind. But if they haven't found themselves, it can become drudgery, and worse, you can inflict yourself on students and want their desire to learn. I'm not sure.
What did you get out of it?
A very satisfactory life. If I had it to do over again, just like I told you 65 years ago, if I had it to do over again, I'd do it with you.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way as that, well, probably is reflected by, at the time I finished my doctorate, I had an opening opportunity at the University of Washington as an associate professor. And I said, how many students can you work with today? And I said, well, you'd rather look at it by the week, because I'm not necessarily going to work with the same student every day. Maybe 100 at a time. She said, why on earth do you want to be surrounded by 22,000 students if you're only going to work with 100 of them? said, and she said, where would you like to live as we have the opportunity to grow up with our three children? I said, that's another unfair question because I would much prefer here. And, end of conversation.
So you have three children?
Yes.
And what are their names?
Carol, whom you met.
Mm-hmm. And
Carol Haddock.
Is she the oldest?
Oh, she's the middle one.
Oh, awesome.
The oldest is Elizabeth Dyer, who just returned 4 days to Portland, according to the information. And our youngest is our son, Tom. Let me go off the record for a moment.
All right.
And bring it
on. One of them was, I was less than 100 pounds. And one of them was my cousin. And I drove 4 miles to school, did the janitor work, carried in wood and made fires because we had to burn wood for the heat. $130 a month, and then it's only 3 months.
Oh, yes.
So that was quite a difference of what teachers make.
So you did that until you got married?
No, I just stopped there 1 year, then I went to, then I got married. And I didn't teach anymore, only just doing substitute up here. And so I went back to. Then when I went back to school, I went to LeGrand and took the No, I went back first to Monmouth and graduated. And then I went to LeGrand.
Oh, okay.
And took in the preparation course so I could go back to school.
And then you went back.
I have a lifetime teaching certificate that I can teach at the Army.
I think you still do a lot of that. And then you were at Baylor for 20 years.
Yeah. Bail. I went to Bail and I stayed there 20 years. And then, because of my age, I was 65, and the ruling then was that you didn't hire teachers over that. They tried to get me in, but they decided they couldn't. So then I was doing substitute work. We bought property up there, home and everything, and we were going to stay there. And then Gentura, you know, Gentura is about 40 miles, I guess, from Bail.
I interject here. I neglected to tell you what the second half of today is. Gerda Brown, whom you all met, is coming. And that'll be a chance for you to practice some of your questioning with her. She's a very easy person to interview. Remembers a lot. And is charming.
Mm-hmm. Eugene, I've noticed that, excuse me for interrupting today, but I do editing of the transcripts, and I find that when you're interviewing, you interrupt more often to ask. I mean, right
yes,
away, Mount Carmel.
I'm kind of pushing that way, yeah.
And I think that it's, as far as when I'm trying to put together this transcript to make it readable, it's much easier if that happens, and whether, I don't know how you're teaching the class, whether the interviewer should be stopping and asking, where's Mount Carmel? I mean, when she said she was teaching, I mean, I've never heard of it before. I thought we were, and then Bail, whether it was Bail.
I do try to remember to do that. I also mm-hmm. try to remember to ask them to spell, especially mm-hmm. proper names.
Oh, proper names, yes.
Ooh. Otherwise, we have to go back and check the spelling. We do anyway. But
yeah.
Yeah, it's...
But locations. I mean, I just think...
If the interviewer can be thinking at least two-dimensionally, that is, the person you're talking directly to and the fact that this is being tape recorded, it's going to be transcribed, it's going to be edited.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Little pieces.
There are at least two levels, that second awareness, the minute level of where is such and such a place, or how do you spell it, anything like that that will help a listener or a reader later on to understand it. And second, on information, especially information that you possess and that in a normal conversation you wouldn't ask the other person to explain more or describe or whatever it is. You know what a
threshing machine
or a pot-bellied stove or whatever it is they mentioned. You've seen it, you know what it is, but if you think, a younger person might not. So then you say, please describe it, or please explain that, or could you give me more detail about that? Even though you know it's not for you, because you already know, but the other person might not.
Especially with some of our farmers and our railroaders that we've interviewed, talking about different machines on the railroad, or what a fireman does, or a brakeman does, or a section man does, or a signal man does, and certainly with all the farm equipment.
Or you know, men mention something like a Fresno.
Yeah.
Oh, we used a Fresno to make that one. Well, Fresno? How do you spell Fresno? Well, I think it's R-E-A-Z. I'm not sure about Z-S, but you know. Well, could you describe what a Fresno looks like? Well, it's kind of a digger thing. It's kind of about 3 feet or wide. And it has teeth on it, and you hook it up to a horse, and it has handles on the back, and a man stands holding these handles, and you get the horse to pull this thing along, and it scoops up dirt, and then you put it over to the side. That's using that when you're making a road. I never knew what a Fresno was before I started this business. And there are a lot of other things like that that will come up. First, you have to think, what was it you said? I didn't understand that word. Would you repeat that, please?
But make sure to feel free to ask questions.
Yes.
As they're telling their tales, or, I mean, describing their backgrounds or their childhood or whatever. I was finishing Roy Leonard, and he used the phrase slip. We used the slip.
Huh?
What's a slip? And then John Turner
later on... It's not something woman wears in this case.
No, not what you wear. And later on John said, oh, by the way, a slip is a shovel kind of thing that you put stuff in. And he just brought it up. I mean, Leonard wasn't using the slip. He was throwing stuff into the slip. It was a big scoop shovel type thing.
Good example.
Slip? I thought I was reading it like, huh? I was ready to read it, and I, you know, went down further and realized what it was, but... Make sure to ask, or at least note it so that you can go back if you don't want to stop their train of thought. That's another way of doing it.
Because I'll give you another definition for it. So.
Yeah.
Pottery.
Yeah. Pottery.
Other comments about this portion of the interview, especially about the interviewer's tactic.
I like the way that she was kind and gentle without being condescending. Because sometimes when people talk to older people, it's how the way they talk to children. And it's very, oh, how are you today? You know,
oh, yeah, honey, that's so nice of you to say that.
And I think it's very disrespectful to the elderly to speak that way. So
it is.
I liked her. Her vocal techniques and how she was very conversational, but I think, you know, I just kept wanting her to dig.
Yes, that's what I go to.
And also realize when you can't. Eugene did one person who he went. I can't remember her name. She was with school's secretary.
Dorothy Boruz.
And Eugene went all the way around and came in from all sorts of different directions to try and get information from her about the school's open.
Things she should have remembered.
She should have remembered, but she had, well, she forgot. I mean, she just, no, I loved every single one of them and he was a perfect boss and this. And then Eugene would go around another and come in from the left side and try and get the same information. And it came up. She just could not remember. She could not recall what the different superintendents were.
And understandably, a number of these people have been retired from whatever their job was for many years. They haven't thought very much about these things. So somebody pops in one sunny day and asks them, well, I don't know.
And how do you feel about them? Well, I loved all my bosses.
Yeah.
You know, and she didn't come up with anything different. And you felt badly because you knew there was information there, but she was past the stage of
So you have to be very tactical.
I knew she isn't senile, though.
No.
She gave me many, many clues that she did remember a lot of things in detail.
So that's why have an opinion about.
That's why I kept at it.
Yeah. No, I thought it was fascinating going through all that one, because I just watched you go right around in a full circle.
Well, there were also three sessions with her.
Yeah.
So the second session, I came back to the things she hadn't told me the first, or tried to get her to tell me.
And she still couldn't?
Well, in some instances, she'd fly more. The videotape, we were down in front of the old LeGrand High School site, where she had worked for many years. She was the board secretary, and where she started working when she was 19 years old, and just having graduated from LeGrand High School, that very building. She was the principal secretary at first. And I think even though the building isn't there, looking at the site started bringing things out. And she did remember a meeting of, at the time the board was going around to the various schools to have meetings, hoping for greater community participation. And hardly anybody was showing up at these meetings. So they went back to meeting at the Grand High School. So she got to telling me about what she finish up work at 5 or 5:30, go home, have a quick something to eat, get back by 6:30 or so, set up the meeting, make the coffee, put out the food, whatever they were going to eat, then take all the minutes for the meeting, and one meeting went till about 2 a.m., and then she supposedly had to clean that up before the next day, but she decided, I can't, I'm way too tired, so I'm going home. So she got back at about 6 in the morning, and then cleaned it up, and went on with her day's work. Now, that was the kind of detail I wanted.
Can I ask one question?
Sure.
Is it okay for us to go to another site with the person? I mean, if something comes up in an interview and maybe, you know, we reschedule something for next week or whatever, can we...
If it seems appropriate, I haven't done that, and I don't think others have, but if you thought it would be helpful, sure.
Okay.
You'd want to be careful about the recording conditions.
Right.
You get outside in the wind on the microphone really makes a lot
and in
of
the car,
thundery noise.
We had one interview in a car, and there was the noise, and they were stopping, and she wasn't always describing where they stopped.
Yeah.
And she was looking at different where to go, such and such school was, or this was, and that was, and you could hear the sound of the car, and the chit-chat that was going on in the car, and then the stopping, and it was...
It does make it harder for you as the interviewer, Brenda,
yeah.
Because... They'll say, oh, yeah, right over there. Mm-hmm. And then you have to somehow say, well, where is there? About so many yards from the street or next to so-and-so.
Right.
So you have to, you then have to supply quite a bit of information in order to make it understandable what you're looking at and talking about. So that would be a main caution, I think.
Mary Ann Svetich. Svetich.
Uh-huh. And how old are you, Mary?
I will be a boy. I don't know, 87 or 88.
Doesn't matter anymore.
I'll be 88 in September.
Uh-huh. And you moved to LeGrand when?
February of 29.
Uh-huh. Background sounds, sometimes, of course, you can't avoid them. I often decide I'm just going to turn off the tape recorder and let them, if they want to go answer it, do that and then come back. In this case, I think they just let it go.
Mm-hmm. When you moved to LeGrand, you moved here from?
Bean Canyon, Utah.
Uh-huh.
And the mining community had only one street that went right up the canyon. The houses were built up on the walls of the canyon. And we had three mines. Down there in the canyon. One was called Hunter Boy Mine. The other one was called Apex Mine. the last one, these two are underground mines.
Oh.
And the last one is a surface mine called Utah Copper Company. Later, Utah Copper was bought out by Kennecott Copper. That's what.
Now, here, you start thinking, maybe I should interrupt. She's talking about Utah, doesn't have anything to do with Union County, but she's talking about her childhood before she came here. Maybe she's going to bring out information about her childhood or her family or what the conditions were there that made them decide to come to La Brea. So maybe I better let her go for a while. Also, in this case, the man who's interviewing her lives across the street from her and has known her for a long time and is adjusting to her personality. If you listen to the whole tape, you will be amazed. It's almost non-stop monologue. Story after one story suggests another story. He can't even get a question in. She won't let him. Her memory is quite good on a lot of details, and so she did rattle on usefully about many aspects. Yeah, oh, even more so.
Diarrhea of the mouth.
Yes.
You'd go for a page and a half.
No,
but I mean, the interviewer and then he'd come to a stop, and he'd take a breath, and you knew he was, you know, there was going to be a break, and then all of a sudden. And it was just nonstop.
However, a great deal of it was relevant.
Oh, yes.
It wasn't really. It was more like a continuous story than it was like an interview. I didn't interview him, but I have talked to him quite a lot afterwards, and I'm realizing this tendency. I interrupt him.
Yeah.
It's kind of rude, I think. He doesn't let the other person say anything, especially when it's supposed to be a kind of a normal conversation.
So we can say something like, I need to interrupt you for just a moment because there was something you said that was really interesting to me, so if we could go back and just...
The obvious tactical or tactful way of doing that, sure. I don't think you should hesitate to do that.
All right.
Although sometimes the personality is so strong, it's difficult. They'll ignore you.
Get a shouting match. Shut up!
This brings up another little question. I mean, it hasn't happened very much, but several of the oral history manuals speak about the possibility that an older person who's often lonely will try to use you as a therapist. Mm-hmm. The kind of therapist who listens patiently. You will sit there for hours and listen to him talk and thereby perform therapy. And then you are being abused. Somehow you can't let that go on, not for very long. As soon as you realize it's happening, you need to figure out, I'm just not going to play that role. I'm going to get my questions in more frequently, even if I have to sit forward and look a little menacing, or whatever your method is for not letting yourself become a victim.
We didn't have it. We had a good school. We didn't have a high school, but we had to go downtown to go to high school. So we had high school here in Greece. But I was disappointed when I came to the Grand and got to the depot in the Grand. This is before they built the new depot.
The new depot was finished in 1930. Mm-hmm. So she got there a couple years before.
The old depot looked dilapidated and old, and I thought, we made an improvement from there to here, you know, this old building. Unfortunately, shortly after that, they built the new depot, and I was really proud of that. The reason for that was the depot in Utah was magnificent, and they had huge murals on the wall depicting all the pilgrims and the covered wagons that had gone. And especially when they hit the railroad and they hit the last spike. I remember hearing about that in Utah. So that was some of the pictures, and I was fascinated by that. Then when I came here to look at this people, there was no such thing. Well, then, when we got to town, it was about, the train came in about 6 o'clock or thereabouts, because it was dinner time and it was dark, still winter. And we got in the taxi, and I can't remember whether we had to have two taxis or if we all got in one. There was mom and 6 kids.
Now, you notice the interviewer is not saying anything. He says, That has been his stance with a number of the people he's interviewed, largely because he has known most of them very well. I think he acknowledges now that that's a slight disadvantage. It's easy to make gain rapport with them, but it's not so easy to establish the interviewer-narrator relationship as if it is if you don't know the person very well. So he was pretty much like that through the rest of the interview. He'd sometimes start a question and then she'd go off, well, that reminds me, and then she'd take control again. We haven't transcribed hers yet, and it's when it's edited, it's going to look like a monologue.
How long is the interview?
I think it's just an hour.
Just an hour. These are great examples. You can give you a whole bunch of different types.
Now, this is Gurita. Not interviewed by me, though.
February 13th, 2003. We are going to get Gurita Broughton's life story today. Okay,
now,
Gurita?
I wanted to go back for just a minute to the first one we heard. Did you notice that she identified herself, the interviewer, who she was interviewing, what the date was, and I forgot whether she said where they were doing the interview. I don't think she did. It's not absolutely essential that you begin that way, but it's often useful to us when we're getting the tape later, those of us who weren't there, if you would start that way. And also, by the way, you must put labels on the tape, on the tape itself, rather than on the box. Sometimes there's a place to write back here. I will take it off and put on the label that I make with a machine, because I think like these to look neat. But when I get a tape that has no identification on it, of course, then I have to listen to it and try to figure out who this was or where I got it. So it will be, and all the tapes have little label things inside. So just use one of those to put on the tape, at least with the narrator's name and the date. And
tape one or tape two?